Position number 21189, wheel 4.
Mr. Kwiatkowski, rear 4.
Before I come back to the Warsaw uprising, I would like to make general comments about that event. I must stress I am not a historian, and obviously all those things took place long time ago. And although I have a very vivid memories of my personal experiences, other statements which I may make may not be absolutely historically correct. One thing which my memory fails is to remember names of people and places. So after that introduction, let me make general comments about the Warsaw Uprising. You can look at it from several aspects: historical, political, military, humane. Now, if we go to the historical aspects, very few people in the West and in this country know or heard about the Warsaw Uprising. If the topics does crop up, that some of them heard about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, which took place a year earlier than the Warsaw Uprising. And it was obviously a suicidal cry to try to attract attention to the world, to the plight of the Jewish people and the whole Holocaust. When I say suicidal, obviously it had no chance of succeeding. But on the other hand, when I talked to Jewish people in the town of Płońsk, when I lived during the war, where there was a ghetto, I always asked them, say, why don't you fight? You know you are going to extermination camps. Everybody knew in Poland about that. So at least take a few Germans with you before you are killed. So the Warsaw Uprising was in that spirit, you know. We are going to be murdered anyway, so let's put up a fight. And I admire the Jews for doing that. But, as I said, it was on a much smaller scale, obviously, than the Warsaw Uprising. The Warsaw Uprising, had the political situation be different, had every chance of success. So this is one historical aspect. The other one was that the Warsaw Uprising was one of the longest battles during the Second World War. It was one of the bloodiest battles of the Second World War. And it was absolutely, definitely the most tragic one. Now, you could compare this with, for example, the battle for Stalingrad. But in Stalingrad, there were two mighty armies fighting each other. While in Warsaw, there were 20,000 or so men armed with bottles, pistols, a few rifles, taking on a German Luftwaffe, artillery, tanks. And, you could compare it to Leningrad, which for quite a long time was more or less cut off. But in Leningrad, this Soviet Union tried to help them, tried to supply them, while in Warsaw quite the opposite happened. Not only that the Russians did not help us, oh, they put a few drops, you know, put sacks of dry bread and dropped it in Warsaw. They couldn't use parachutes because by that time, if they dropped something by parachute, probably would carry it on to German position. They dropped some ammunition, which most of it, again, in sacks, without, you know, just drop it. Most of it was completely damaged. So all we could do was to remove the explosives from the rifle bullets and make them into grenades. Now, the American help, which was, I think, about 100 B-39s or whichever bombers we brought. But it came too late, and there was too little. The excuse was that we could, that Warsaw was too far. The bombers could not fly to Warsaw and back again. So they needed the permission of the Soviets for the American aeroplanes to land. And that would be on the Polish territory. You know. And the Russians were refusing. I think Churchill made some big noises, and he even suggested that all the supplies to Soviet Union be stopped unless they were. But Roosevelt was so keen not to offend the Russians, to try to persuade them to join the Americans in a war against Japan, that he didn't want to offend them in any way, so never mind about Poles, you know. So that's the historical background to it. Now the political, as I said earlier, Stalin decided, let's get rid of the Poles in Warsaw who would oppose communist regime, and the Germans will do it for us. At first, well, the Soviet offensive towards Warsaw was nearing its end, its momentum, and so on. And the Germans put up some defense, and you may argue that the Germans did stop the Russians on the outskirts of Warsaw, but that's only for a few weeks, because a month later the Russians took Prague, and we could see the Russian tanks driving along the Vistula River on the other side, but they would not come. So politically, it was doomed to failure. Now, what could the Poles do? Whatever we did would be to our disadvantage. If we didn't rise, the Russians would say, well, you know, there is no Polish resistance, they didn't find anyway. The Soviet radio stations were calling on the people of Warsaw to rise. So the other aspect, very important one, of on the military side, was that the Germans ordered all able men to report with shovels and pickaxes and so on to build defenses of Warsaw. And Hitler declared Warsaw the as a fortress of Warsaw. What's the German words? Escapes me now. Rundschau Warsaw, whatever, anyway. So it was absolutely obvious, certain, that the Germans will defend Warsaw. In which case, the destruction of Warsaw would be exactly the same as it was because of the uprising. How many people would be killed, that it would depend how many, what would the Germans allow, how many of the inhabitants of Warsaw to move out of Warsaw. And the threat that there will, when the Germans issued that order to put posters all over the city, that's the giving the places where the men are to assemble, that was ignored by the Poles. Hardly anybody, I think there were a few who came up, but the absolute majority did not respond. And they issued another order next day, and again it was ignored. It was obvious that the Germans would have to do something about it. They could not tolerate a completely that the Poles disobey their orders and instructions. So they would start taking people, drag them from houses, you know, from streets and whatever. That would completely disorganize the Polish underground, because obviously among them there would be people who belong to the Home Army. And so there was the additional aspect to start the uprising. The question of timing, well, that was difficult. the idea was that we will try to engage the Germans inside the city to make it easier for the Russians to enter it, and that it would last 3-5 days. As it happened, it lasted 63 days. There were mistakes on this Polish side. The decision to have an uprising in Warsaw was taken very late by the, well, as a matter of fact, the Polish government in London just passed the baton to General Bukowski. You decide. Well, now, have that decision been, the general decision that there will be an uprising in Warsaw taken earlier, then perhaps you would have more arms, because a lot of the partisan units which were supplied by airdrops from Britain, actually from Italy mostly, you know, they were directed to the Polish units in eastern part of Poland. So that was a mistake. Now, as far as the actual timing, the Polish intelligence was reasonably good. And General Komorowski and the leaders in the uprising got the wrong message from the Polish intelligence. They were maintaining that the Russian tanks are already entering Prague, which they weren't. The NSZ had the right information. It said, nowhere, there are no Russians anywhere here. And finally, originally, it was intended during the first mobilization on Thursday, the before Tuesday, when the actual fighting started, the original idea was that the fighting will start at night, that we will attack German-occupied buildings, barracks, what have you, at night. That, in my view, was a completely stupid idea, because if the Germans were in their barracks, in bunkers and behind barbed wires, what chance would we have? So the later idea, which actually was carried out, that the uprising would take place where it was fixed for 5 o'clock in the afternoon, where the actual fighting started at about 3, because, you know, the army, home army units came across some German patrols, and that's how the, you know, firing started, you know. But it was much better idea, because the Germans were in town, around the town, it was easier to attack them, it was easier to gain weapons from them, you know, when they were out and about, rather than attacking them in fortified buildings, you know. Unfortunately, the time scale between the order given to start the uprising at 5 o'clock on the 1st of August, that order was issued so late that most of the units didn't get it. And those who did get the order, they didn't have time to get their weapons from whenever they were hiding them, to get them to the units. So in general, there was a chaos. Now, one could say that it was all one big blunder. Now consider what blunders were committed by chiefs of staffs of regular army. In Italy, the Americans lost twice chances for advancing quickly. Kesselring, the commander, Field Marshal Kesselring, could not believe it, that he got, you know, that after the first landing, the Americans were assembling on the beaches and so on. There were no Germans, so it was complete disarray. It lasted 3 or 4 days. By that time, the Germans organized themselves. The second one, what was his name? The commander of the...
Montgomery?
No, the American.
Patton?
No.
Eisenhower.
No. Just in Italy. Your name will come to me.
Mark Clark.
He disobeyed direct order to advance. And once Cassino was taken, Monte Cassino, and the Allied forces were advancing north, he was given a strict order to pursue the retreating Germans. Now, he went to Rome for a military victory parade. And Kesselring got away with it again. And then it cost the Allies, including the Americans, thousands of lives to take, to occupy the territory which was wide open originally. So, you take the D-Day, when one of the landing groups, the American ones, landed on the wrong beach. With, big fleet, air force and everything, and we land on the wrong beach. The parachutists were dropped in the middle of the town, dropping on roofs and hanging from... So, you can carry on with the blunder. So if the people with all the... with complete control, with information, with intelligence, with reconnaissance and so on, if they make blunders, how couldn't we? And forget that General Komorowski had to hide from the Germans. He said, all right, he was in radio contact with the Polish government in London, but the conditions under which he was working was completely incomparable. And finally, let's go to the human aspect of it. I must show you this. I got in front of me a book called The World at War. It's a Reader's Digest Illustrated History of World War II. On page... 406. Okay. On page 465, under the title Human Cost of the War, there is a table which gives the population of various nationalities, the total armed forces killed or missing, and the total civilian killed or missing. If you take Britain, if you add the total number of armed forces killed and missing and the total civilian killed or missing, that represents just over 1% of the British population. If you take the American number of killed and missing, it's less than 0.2%. Now, numerically, by miles, the heaviest casualties suffered the Russians, which, if you add those two, that's 21.3 million people. But that represents 11% of the Soviet Union population. Poland lost 19%. So every fifth person in Poland was killed, or murdered, or executed, or what have you. So that gives you the scale of the human suffering of Polish people. Those, of course, include Jews, but Jews were Poles and were Polish citizens and were treated as such by the Poles and considered like that. Some of them were great Polish patriots. Now, if you look at it from another scale, there are several cemeteries in Warsaw. There is a military cemetery where there are buried Polish soldiers, and this is an old one. It goes back. There are graves of Poles taking part in the January's uprising in 1863, so it goes as far as that, right up to the Second World War. And they are, but only the military personnel are buried there, and the Polish soldiers of the uprising, either they are buried there or just memorative plaques are placed there. But by far the biggest is a cemetery in Wola. The first one was called Powązki Cemetery, the military cemetery in Powązki. Now then, the one in Wola, where majority are the civilians who are buried there, if you go there, there are no individual graves, a group of people varying from 10 to 200, 300. And on those graves, there are names and ages given, which vary from a few weeks to over 90. But the center part of it is a grave which are buried the remains of 50,000 people in one grave. The total number of civilian killed and missing in Britain is 70,000. So almost as many Warsawians are buried, or remains of them are buried in one grave, than the total civilian population do. So that's the human scale. Can we make a short break, please? I will go back to this transporting of the machine gun before the uprising, about a week or so before the uprising took place. The machine gun was bought from Germans. Germans were selling arms, you know. And it was hidden in a house of the parents of one of members of our platoon in Saskakempa, which is a sort of exclusive district, residential district, on the east side of the Vistula River, just south of the Poniatowski Bridge. We received the order to bring this machine gun to western part of Warsaw, where we had the headquarters of our platoon, you can call them that. I was given 5 pistols and ordered to go by tram across Poniatowski Bridge, and at the tram stop on the other side, a chappie whom I knew will wait for me, and he will take me to the place where the machine gun was hidden. Can you imagine? There I was. I had a dispatcher case in which I think I had 5, I might have 6 pistols. I put 4 into the dispatcher case and 1 under my jacket behind the belt, and just chanced that the tram won't be stopped by the Germans, which I twice before I have been caught in such a ambush, if you like. Well, luckily enough, I arrived at the tram stop. The chappie was waiting for me, and he took me to this house. 4 or 5 of us involved. The problem was that the fellow, his pseudonym was Zuchwały, he wasn't there. And we sat and waited where he will come, because we didn't know where the machine gun was hidden. Eventually, he arrived. Along the Vistula River, the Germans were building anti-aircraft positions and artillery positions and so on. And to build it, they were catching people, were picking people from the street and from the trams and ordering them to dig up position trenches, what have you. And this fellow, Zuchwały, on his way home, got caught by them. And he spent a couple of hours digging up German trenches. And that's why he was late arriving at his home. After he arrived, well, apparently the machine gun was hidden in a cellar under a pile of coal or something, anyway. Now, the question was, how are we going to transport this machine gun? A lot of our actions against Germany were planned in advance in details, but a lot were just ad hoc. You had to improvise as the things went on. But even before that, we were considering, well, how can we get it across? You could hire a kayak on the Vistula just for pleasure purposes. We were considering that, you know, put it on a kayak, sail across the other side. But that didn't look very practical, especially that it would be somewhere near Poniatowski Bridge and nobody on the river was allowed to come near in any boat near the bridge, and there were guards there, and if any boat strayed somewhere near, they were shooting at them. So the when eventually we all asked someone, so now what are we going to do? And the first idea was that we would wrap it up in some sacks and so on and take it on a tram. There's no other means of transport, and you know. And I opposed this. I said, no, never. For two reasons. The trams were completely packed with people. To make sure that all six of us will get on the same tram, you know, was very high-stretched. But the more important one was, if the Germans stopped us, or tried to stop us, we would have to start firing at them. They would fire back, not just at us, but all the people traveling on the tram. So I said, no way. We can even be stopped before we board the tram to be sent like our friend who was 2 hours ago to the government. So I said, the only way we can do it is by requisitioning some sort of a lorry, vehicle, or something like that. I said, well, don't be stupid. Where do we find a lorry in a residential area? So, well, we have to go somewhere farther afield, you know, and that's the only chance which we have. So we sent a small patrol of two or three chaps, and but after, you know, 20 minutes or so, they came back, so not a chance, there are no lorries around. But I still insisted, and the fellow who was the deputy commander of the platoon, who was in charge of this operation, because he knew me from earlier actions and so on, and he knew that I have experience. Actually, we did stack up, the two of us, a lorry before in the center of Warsaw. So he was wavering, but said, well, you know, probably my opinion carried more weight than the other chaps who were, by the way, all of them were from a Polish officer school, the conspiratorial officer school, but with, as far as I knew, with very little experience of actual actions, you know, in German. So the two of us walked out. And to the south of the Poniatowski Bridge on the eastern side,